Spell the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 65, presenting chapters 10 and 11 of When the World Shook by H. Rider Haggard. Again, we have two chapters of slightly more than 20 minutes apiece. There's a mention of the Temple of Abu Simbel at the First Cataract of the Nile, which, during the live stream, gave me occasion for a long digression about Lake Gamal Abdel Nasser and its implications for the people of Egypt, and the curious gift of an entire Egyptian temple to Lyndon Johnson, which you may see if you go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York City. I also note what may well be the first appearance in literature of the term suspended animation, an intriguing thought to be sure. Bickley makes an utterly preposterous statement about radium. The half-life of radium-226 is only 1,600 years. For this kind of case, what you would want is probably neptunium-237 with a half-life of 2.2 million years, or possibly plutonium-242 with a half-life of 379,000 years. Curium-248, with a half-life of 470,000 years, would be suitable if only 10% of its decays were not by spontaneous fission, which really complicates life. The other two are pure alpha emitters, which makes them good heat sources. Of course, these can only be manufactured in a nuclear fission reactor, and the United States government has hundreds of kilograms of neptunium socked away, potentially awaiting transmutation into plutonium-238, which is used as a heat source for space probes. Also, when we come to the succeeding chapters, it will be discovered that Arbuthnot, in Chapter 10, has unwittingly become some kind of a prophet of Oro. Or, of course, perhaps it may be the mysterious telepathic influence which, along with spiritualism, mesmerism, and the very latest advances of modern medical and physical science, populate this story in a rather confusing way. Chapter 10. The Dwellers in the Tomb. By now it was drawing towards sunset, so we made such preparations as we could for the night. One of these was to collect dry driftwood, of which an abundance lay upon the shore to serve us for firing, though, unfortunately, we had nothing that we could cook for our meal. While we were thus engaged, we saw a canoe approaching the Table Rock, and perceived that in it were the chief Marama and a priest. After hovering about for a while, they paddled the canoe near enough to allow of conversation, which, taking no notice of their presence, we left it to them to begin. "O friend from the sea," called Marama, addressing myself, "we come to pray you and the great healer to return to us to be our guests as before. The people are covered with darkness because of the loss of your wisdom, and the sick cry aloud for the healer. Indeed, two of those whom he has cut with knives are dying."
"And what of the bellower?" I asked, indicating Bastin.
"We should like to see him back also, friend from the sea, that we may sacrifice and eat him who destroyed our god with fire and caused the healer to kill his priest."
"That is most unjust," exclaimed Bastin. "I deeply regret the blood that was shed on the occasion, unnecessarily, as I think."
"Then go and atone for it with your own," said Bickley, "and everybody will be pleased."
Waving to them to be silent, I said, "Are you mad, Marama, that you should ask us to return to sojourn among people who tried to kill us, merely because the bellower caused fire to burn an image of wood and its head to fly from its shoulders, just to show you that it had no power to hold itself together, although you call it a god? Not so. We wash our hands of you. We leave you to go your own way while we go ours. Till, perchance in a day to come, after many misfortunes have overtaken you, you creep about our feet, and with prayers and offerings, beg us to return." I paused to observe the effect of my words. It was excellent, for both Marama and the priest wrung their hands and groaned. Then I went on. "Meanwhile, we have something to tell you.
We have entered the cave where you said no man might set a foot, and have seen him who sits within, the true god. Here, Baston tried to interrupt, but was suppressed by Bickley. They looked at each other in a frightened way, and groaned more loudly than before. He sends you a message which, as he told us of your approach, we came to the shore to deliver to you.
How can you say that? Began Baston, but was again violently suppressed by Bickley.
It is that he, the real Oro, rejoices that the false Oro, whose face is copied from his face, has been destroyed. It is that he commands you day by day to bring food in plenty and lay it upon the rock of offerings, not forgetting a supply of fresh fish from the sea, and with it all those things that are stored in the house wherein we, the strangers from the sea, deigned to dwell a while until we left you, because in your wickedness you wished to murder us.
And if we refuse, what then? Asked the priest, speaking for the first time.
Then Oro will send death and destruction upon you. Then your food shall fail, and you shall perish of sickness and want, and the Oromatuas, the spirits of the great dead, shall haunt you in your sleep, and Oro shall eat up your souls. At these horrible threats, both of them uttered a kind of wail, after which Marama asked,
And if we consent, what then, friend from the sea?
Then, perchance, I answered, in some day to come we may return to you, that I may give you of my wisdom, and the great healer may cure your sick, and the bellower may lead you through his gate, and in his kindness make you to see with his eyes. This last clause of my ultimatum did not seem to appeal to the priest, who argued a while with Marama, though what he said we could not hear. In the end he appeared to give way. At any rate, Marama called out that all should be done as we wished, and that meanwhile they prayed us to intercede with Oro in the cave, and to keep back the ghosts from haunting them, and to protect them from misfortune. I replied that we would do our best, but could guarantee nothing, since their offense was very great. Then, to show that the conversation was at an end, we walked away with dignity, pushing Baston in front of us lest he should spoil the effect by some of his ill-timed and often over-true remarks.
That's capital, said Bickley, when we were out of hearing. The enemy has capitulated. We can stop here as long as we like, provisioned from the mainland, and if for any reason we wish to leave, be sure of our line of retreat.
I don't know what you call capital, exclaimed Baston. It seems to me that all the lies which Arbuthnot has just told are sufficient to bring a judgment upon us. Indeed, I think that I will go back with Marama and explain the truth.
I never before knew anybody who was so anxious to be cooked and eaten, remarked Bickley. Moreover, you are too late, for the canoe is 100 yards away by now, and you shan't have ours. Remember the Pauline maxims, old fellow, which you are so fond of quoting, and be all things to all men, and another that is more modern, that when you are at Rome you must do as the Romans do, also a third, that necessity has no law, and, for the matter of that, a fourth, that all is fair in love and war.
I am sure, Bickley, that Paul never meant his words to bear the debased sense which you attribute to them,
began Baston. But at this point I hustled him off to light a fire, a process at which, I pointed out, he had shown himself an expert. We slept that night under the overhanging rock just to one side of the cave, not in the mouth, because of the draft which drew in and out of the great place. In that soft and balmy clime this was no hardship, although we lacked blankets, and yet, tired though I was, I could not rest as I should have done. Baston snored away contentedly, quite unaffected by his escape, which to him was merely an incident of the day's work, and so too slumbered Bickley, except that he did not snore. But the amazement and the mystery of all that we had discovered, and of all that might be left for us to discover, held me back from sleep. What did it mean? What could it mean? My nerves were taut as harp strings, and seemed to vibrate to the touch of invisible fingers, although I could not interpret the music that they made. Once or twice also I thought I heard actual music with my physical ears, and that of a strange quality. Soft and low and dreamful, it appeared to well from the recesses of the vast cave. A wailing song in an unknown tongue from the lips of women, or of a woman, multiplied mysteriously by echoes. This, however, must have been pure fancy, since there was no singer there. Presently I dozed off, to be awakened by the sudden sound of a great fish leaping in the lake. I sat up and stared, fearing lest it should be the splash of a paddle, for I could not put from my mind the possibility of attack. All I saw, however, was the low line of the distant shore, and above it the bright and setting stars that heralded the coming of the sun. Then I woke the others, and we washed and ate, since once the sun rose time would be precious. At length it appeared, splendid in a cloudless sky, and as I had hoped, directly opposite to the mouth of the cave. Taking our candles and some stout pieces of driftwood, which, with our knives, we had shaped on the previous evening to serve us as levers and rough shovels, we entered the cave. Bickley and I were filled with excitement and hope, of what we knew not. But Baston showed little enthusiasm for our quest. His heart was with his half-converted savages beyond the lake,
and of them, quite rightly I have no doubt, he thought more than he did of all the archaeological treasures in the whole earth. Still, he came, bearing the blackened head of Oro with him, which, with unconscious humor, he had used as a pillow through the night, because, as he said, it was, after all, softer than stone. Also, I believe that in his heart he hoped that he might find an opportunity of destroying the bigger and earlier edition of Oro in the cave, before it was discovered by the natives, who might wish to make it an object of worship. Tommy came also, with greater alacrity than I expected, since dogs do not as a rule like dark places. When we reached the statue, I learned the reason. He remembered the smell he had detected at its base on the previous day, which Baston supposed to proceed from a rat, and was anxious to continue his investigations. We went straight to the statue, although Bickley passed the half-buried machines with evident regret. As we had hoped, the strong light of the rising sun fell upon it in a vivid ray, revealing all its wondrous workmanship and the majesty, for no other word describes it, of the somewhat terrifying countenance that appeared above the wrappings of the shroud. Indeed, I was convinced that originally this monument had been placed here, in order that on certain days of the year the sun might fall upon it thus, when, probably, worshippers assembled to adore their hallowed symbol. After all, this was common in ancient days. Witness the instance of the awful three who sit in the deepest recesses of the temple of Abu Simbel on the Nile. We gazed and gazed our fill, at least Bickley and I did, for Baston was occupied in making a careful comparison between the head of his wooden Oro and that of the statue.
"There is no doubt that they are very much alike," he said. "Why, whatever is that dog doing? I think it is going mad."
And he pointed to Tommy, who was digging furiously at the base of the lowest step, as at home I have seen him do at roots that sheltered a rabbit. Tommy's energy was so remarkable that at length it seriously attracted our attention. Evidently he meant that it should do so, for occasionally he sprang back to me, barking, then returned and sniffed and scratched. Bickley knelt down and smelt at the stone. "It is an odd thing, Humphrey," he said. "But there is a strange odor here, a very pleasant odor like that of sandalwood or attar of roses."
"I never heard of a rat that smelt like sandalwood or attar of roses," said Baston. "Look out that it isn't a snake."
I knelt down beside Bickley, and in clearing away the deep dust from what seemed to be the bottom of the step, which was perhaps 4 feet in height, by accident thrust my amateur spade somewhat strongly against its base, where it rested upon the rocky floor. Next moment a wonder came to pass. The whole massive rock began to turn outwards as though upon a pivot. I saw it coming, and grabbed Bickley by the collar, dragging him back so that we just rolled clear before the great block, which must have weighed several tons, fell down and crushed us. Tommy saw it too, and fled, though a little late, for the edge of the block caught the tip of his tail and caused him to emit a most piercing howl. But we did not think of Tommy and his woes. We did not think of our own escape or of anything else because of the marvel that appeared to us. Seated there upon the ground, after our backward tumble, we could see into the space which lay behind the fallen step, for there the light of the sun penetrated. The first idea it gave me was that of the jeweled shrine of some medieval saint, which, by good fortune, had escaped the plunderers. There are still such existing in the world. It shone and glittered, apparently with gold and diamonds, although, as a matter of fact, there were no diamonds, nor was it gold which gleamed, but some ancient metal, or rather amalgam, which is now lost to the world, the same that was used in the tubes of the air machines. I think that it contained gold, but I do not know. At any rate, it was equally lasting and even more beautiful, though lighter in color. For the rest, this adorned recess, which resembled that of a large funeral vault, occupying the whole space beneath the base of the statue that was supported on its arch, was empty save for two flashing objects that lay side by side, but with nearly the whole width of the vault between them. I pointed at them to Bickley with my finger, for really I could not speak. "Coffins, by Jove!" he whispered. "Glass or crystal coffins, and people in them! Come on!" A few seconds later we were crawling into that vault, while Baston, still nursing the head of Oro as though it were a baby, stood confused outside, muttering something about desecrating hallowed graves. Just as we reached the interior, owing to the heightening of the sun, the light passed away, leaving us in a kind of twilight. Bickley produced carriage candles from his pocket and fumbled for matches. While he was doing so, I noticed two things. First, that the place really did smell like a scent shop, and secondly, that the coffins seemed to glow with a kind of phosphorescent light of their own, not very strong, but sufficient to reveal their outlines in the gloom. Then the candles burnt up, and we saw. Within the coffin that stood on our left hand as we entered, for this crystal was as transparent as plate glass, lay a most wonderful old man, clad in a gleaming embroidered robe. His long hair, which was parted in the middle as we could see beneath the edge of the pearl-sewn and embroidered cap he wore, also his beard, were snowy white. The man was tall, at least 6 feet 4 inches in height, and rather spare. His hands were long and thin, very delicately made, as were his sandaled feet. But it was his face that fixed our gaze, for it was marvelous, like the face of a god, and, as we noticed at once, with some resemblance to that of the statue above. Thus, the brow was broad and massive, the nose straight and long, the mouth stern and clear-cut, while the cheekbones were rather high and the eyebrows arched. Such are the characteristics of many handsome old men of good blood, and, as the mummies of Seti and others show us, such they have been for thousands of years. Only this man differed from all others because of the fearful dignity stamped upon his features. Looking at him, I began to think at once of the prophet Elijah as he must have appeared rising to heaven, enhanced by the more earthly glory of Solomon. For, although the appearance of these patriarchs is unknown, of them one conceives ideas. Only it seemed probable that Elijah may have looked more benign. Here there was no benignity, only terrible force and infinite wisdom. Contemplating him, I shivered a little and felt thankful that he was dead. For to tell the truth, I was afraid of that awesome countenance, which, I should add, was of the whiteness of paper, although the cheeks still showed tinges of color, so perfect was the preservation of the corpse. I was still gazing at it when Bickley said in a voice of astonishment, "I say, look here in the other coffin." I turned, looked, and nearly collapsed on the floor of the vault, since beauty can sometimes strike us like a blow. Oh, there before me lay all loveliness, such loveliness that there burst from my lips an involuntary cry, "Alas, that she should be dead!" A young woman, I supposed, at least she looked young, perhaps 5 or 26 years of age, or so I judged. There she lay, her tall and delicate shape half hidden in masses of rich-hued hair, in color of a ruddy blackness. I know not how else to describe it, since never have I seen any of the same tint. Moreover, it shone with a life of its own, as though it had been dusted with gold. From between the masses of this hair appeared a face which I can only call divine. There was every beauty that woman can boast, from the curving eyelashes of extraordinary length to the sweet and human mouth. To these charms also were added a wondrous smile and an air of kind dignity, very different from the fierce pride stamped upon the countenance of the old man who was her companion in death. She was clothed in some close-fitting robe of white broidered with gold. Pearls were about her neck, lying far down upon the perfect bosom. A girdle of gold and shining gems encircled her slender waist, and on her little feet were sandals fastened with red stones like rubies. In truth, she was a splendid creature, and yet, I know not how, her beauty suggested more of the spirit than of the flesh. Indeed, in a way, it was unearthly. My senses were smitten. It pulled at my heartstrings, and yet its unutterable strangeness seemed to awake memories within me, though of what I could not tell. A wild fancy came to me that I must have known this heavenly creature in some past life. By now, Baston had joined us, and, attracted by my exclamation and by the attitude of Bickley, who was staring down at the coffin with a fixed look upon his face, not unlike that of a pointer when he scents game, he began to contemplate the wonder within it in his slow way.
"Well, I never," he said. "Do you think the glittering lady in there is human?"
"The glittering lady is dead, but I suppose that she was human in her life," I answered, in an awed whisper.
"Of course she is dead, otherwise she would not be in that glass coffin. I think I should like to read the burial service over her, which I dare say was never done when she was put in there."
"How do you know she is dead?" asked Bickley, in a sharp voice and speaking for the first time. "I have seen hundreds of corpses, and mummies too, but never any that looked like these." I stared at him. It was strange to hear Bickley, the scoffer at miracles, suggesting that the greatest of all miracles might be possible. "They must have been here a long time," I said, "for although human, they are not, I think, of any people known to the world today. Their dress, everything shows it, though perhaps thousands of years ago." And I stopped. "Quite so," answered Bickley. "I agree. That is why I suggest they may have belonged to a race who knew what we do not, namely, how to suspend animation for great periods of time." I said no more, nor did Baston, who was now engaged in studying the old man, and for once wonderstruck and overcome. Bickley, however, took one of the candles and began to make a close examination of the coffins. So did Tommy, who sniffed along the join of that of the glittering lady until his nose reached a certain spot, where it remained, while his black tail began to wag in a delighted fashion. Bickley pushed him away and investigated. "As I thought," he said. "Air holes, see?" I looked, and there, bored through the crystal of the coffin in a line with the face of its occupant, were a number of little holes that either by accident or design outlined the shape of a human mouth. "They are not airtight," murmured Bickley, "and if air can enter, how can dead flesh remain like that for ages?" Then he continued his search upon the other side. "The lid of this coffin works on hinges," he said. "Here they are, fashioned to the crystal itself. A living person within could have pulled it down before the senses departed."
"No,"
I answered, "for look, here is a crystal bolt at the end, and it is shot from without." This puzzled him. Then, as though struck by an idea, he began to examine the other coffin. "I've got it!" he exclaimed presently. "The old god in here!" Somehow, we all thought of this old man as not quite normal. "Shut down the glittering lady's coffin and bolted it. His own is not bolted, although the bolt exists in the same place. He just got in and pulled down the lid. Oh, what nonsense I am talking, for how can such things be? Let us get out and think." So we crept from the sepulchre, in which the perfumed air had begun to oppress us, and set ourselves down upon the floor of the cave, where for a while we remained silent.
"I am very thirsty," said Baston presently. "The smells seem to have dried me up. I am going to get some tea. I mean, water, as unfortunately there is no tea."
And he set off towards the mouth of the cave. We followed him. I don't know quite why, except that we wished to breathe freely outside. Also, we knew that the sepulchre and its contents would be as safe as they had been for, well, how long? It proved to be a beautiful morning outside. We walked up and down, enjoying it subconsciously, for really our, that is, Bickley's and my own, intelligences were concentrated on that sepulchre and its contents. Where Baston's may have been, I do not know, perhaps in a visionary teapot, since I was sure that it would take him a day or two to appreciate the significance of our discoveries. At any rate, he wandered off, making no remarks about them, to drink water, I suppose. Presently he began to shout to us from the end of the Table Rock, and we went to see the reason for his noise. It proved to be very satisfactory, for while we were in the cave, the Orophanans had brought absolutely everything belonging to us, together with a large supply of food from the main island. Not a single article was missing. Even our books, a can with the bottom out, and the broken pieces of a little pocket mirror had been religiously transported, and with these a few articles had been stolen from us, notably my pocket knife. Evidently a great taboo had been laid upon all our possessions. They were now carefully arranged in one of the grooves of the rock that Bickley supposed had been made by the wheels of aeroplanes, which is why we had not seen them at once. Each of us rushed for what we desired most. Baston for one of the canisters of tea, I for my diaries, and Bickley for his chest of instruments and medicines. These were removed to the mouth of the cave, and after them the other things and the food, also a bell tent and some camp furniture that we had brought from the ship. Then Baston made some tree, of which he drank four large pannikins, having first said grace over it with unwonted fervor. Nor did we disdain our share of the beverage, although Bickley preferred cocoa and I coffee. Cocoa and coffee we had no time to make then, and in view of that sepulchre in the cave, what had we to do with cocoa and coffee? So Bickley and I said to each other, and yet presently he changed his mind, and in a special metal machine carefully made some extremely strong black coffee, which he poured into a thermos flask, previously warmed with hot water, adding thereto about a claret glass of brandy. Also he extracted certain drugs from his medicine chest, and with them, as I noted, a hypodermic syringe, which he first boiled in a kettle and then shut up in a little tube with a glass stopper. These preparations finished, he called to Tommy to give him the scraps of our meal. But there was no Tommy. The dog was missing, and though we hunted everywhere, we could not find him. Finally, we concluded that he had wandered off down the beach on business of his own, and would return in due course. We could not bother about Tommy just then. After making some further preparations and fidgeting about a little, Bickley announced that as we had now some proper paraffin lamps of the powerful sort which are known as Hurricane, he proposed by their aid to carry out further examinations in the cave.
"I think I shall stop where I am," said Baston, helping himself from the kettle to a fifth pannikin of tea. "These corpses are very interesting, but I don't see any use in staring at them again at present. One can always do that at any time. I have missed Marama once already by being away in that cave, and I have a lot to say to him about my people. I don't want to be absent in case he should return."
"To wash up the things, I suppose," said Bickley with a sniff, "or perhaps to eat the tea leaves."
"Well, as a matter of fact, I have noticed that these natives have a peculiar taste for tea leaves. I think they believe them to be a medicine, but I don't suppose they would come so far for them, though perhaps they might in hope of getting the head of Oro. Anyhow, I am going to stop here."
"Pray do," said Bickley. "Are you ready, Humphrey?" I nodded, and he handed to me a felt-covered flask of non-conducting kind, filled with boiling water, a tin of preserved milk, and a little bottle of meat extract of a most concentrated sort. Then, having lit two of the hurricane lamps and seen that they were full of oil, we started back up the cave.
Chapter 11. Resurrection.
We reached the sepulchre without stopping to look at the parked machines, or even the marvelous statue that stood above it, for what did we care about machines or statues now? As we approached, we were astonished to hear low and cavernous growlings.
There is some wild beast in there, said Bickley, halting. No, by George, it's Tommy. What can the dog be after? We peeped in, and there, sure enough, was Tommy, lying on the top of the glittering lady's coffin, and growling his very best with a hair standing up upon his back. When he saw who it was, however, he jumped off and frisked around, licking my hand. That's very strange, I exclaimed. No stranger than everything else, said Bickley. What are you going to do? I asked. Open these coffins, he answered, beginning with that of the old god, since I would rather experiment on him. I expect he will crumble into dust, but if by chance he doesn't, I'll jam a little strychnine, mixed with some other drugs, of which you don't know the names, into one of his veins and see if anything happens. If it doesn't, it won't hurt him, and if it does, well, who knows? Now, give me a hand. We went to the left-hand coffin, and, by inserting a hook on the back of my knife, of which the real use is to pick stones out of horses' hoofs, into one of the little air holes I have described, managed to raise the heavy crystal lid sufficiently to enable us to force a piece of wood between it and the top. The rest was easy, for the hinges, being of crystal, had not corroded. From the chest came an overwhelming spicy odor, and with it a veritable breath of warm air before which we recoiled a little. Bickley took a pocket thermometer which he had at hand and glanced at it. It marked a temperature of 82 degrees in the sepulchre. Having noted this, he thrust it into the coffin between the crystal wall and its occupant. Then we went out and waited a little while to give the odors time to dissipate, for they made the head reel. After 5 minutes or so, we returned and examined the thermometer. It had risen to 98 degrees, the natural temperature of the human body. "What do you make of that if the man is dead?" he whispered. I shook my head, and as we had agreed, set to helping him lift the body from the coffin. It was a good weight, quite 11 stone, I should say. Moreover, it was not stiff, for the hip joints bent. We got it out and laid it on a blanket we had spread on the floor of the sepulchre. Whilst I was thus engaged, I saw something that nearly caused me to loose my hold from astonishment. Behind the head, the center of the back, and the feet were crystal boxes about 8 inches square, or rather, crystal blocks, for in them I could see no opening, and these boxes emitted a faint phosphorescent light. I touched one of them, and found that it was quite warm. "Great heavens!" I exclaimed. "Here's magic!" "There's no such thing," answered Bickley, in his usual formula. Then an explanation seemed to strike him, and he added, "Not magic, but radium or something of the sort. That's how the temperature was kept up. In sufficient quantity, it is practically indestructible, you see. My word, this old gentleman knew a thing or two." Again, we waited a little while to see if the body began to crumble on exposure to the air, I taking the opportunity to make a rough sketch of it in my pocketbook in anticipation of that event. But it did not. It remained quite sound. "Here goes," said Bickley. "If he should be alive, he will catch cold in his lungs after lying for ages in that incubator, as I suppose he has done, so it is now or never." Then, bidding me hold the man's right arm, he took the sterilized syringe which he had prepared, and thrusting the needle into a vein he selected just above the wrist, injected the contents. "It would have been better over the heart," he whispered, "but I thought I would try the arm first. I don't like risking chills by uncovering him." I made no answer, and again we waited and watched. "Great heavens, he's stirring!" I gasped presently. Stirring he was, for his fingers began to move. Bickley bent down and placed his ear to the heart. I forgot to say that he had tested this before with a stethoscope, but had been unable to detect any movement. "I believe it is beginning to beat," he said, in an awed voice. Then he applied the stethoscope and added, "It is! It is!" Next, he took a filament of cotton wool and laid it on the man's lips. Presently, it moved. He was breathing, though very faintly. Bickley took some more cotton wool, and having poured something from his medicine chest onto it, placed it over the mouth beneath the man's nostrils. I believe it was sal volatile. Nothing further happened for a little while, and to relieve the strain on my mind, I stared absently into the empty coffin. Here I saw what had escaped our notice, 2 small plates of white metal, and cut upon them what I took to be star maps. Beyond these, and the glowing boxes which I have mentioned, there was nothing else in the coffin. I had no time to examine them, for at that moment the old man opened his mouth and began to breathe, evidently with some discomfort and effort, as his empty lungs filled themselves with air. Then his eyelids lifted, revealing a wonderful pair of dark glowing eyes beneath. Next, he tried to sit up, but would have fallen had not Bickley supported him with his arm. I do not think he saw Bickley. Indeed, he shut his eyes again as though the light hurt them, and went into a kind of faint. Then it was that Tommy, who all this while had been watching the proceedings with grave interest, came forward, wagging his tail, and licked the man's face. At the touch of the dog's red tongue, he opened his eyes for the second time. Now he saw, not us, but Tommy, for after contemplating him for a few seconds, something like a smile appeared upon his fierce but noble face. More, he lifted his hand and laid it on the dog's head as though to pat it kindly. Half a minute or so later, his awakening senses appreciated our presence. The incipient smile vanished, and was replaced by a somewhat terrible frown.
Meanwhile, Bickley had poured out some of the hot coffee laced with brandy into the cup that was screwed on the top of the thermos flask. Advancing to the man, whom I supported, he put it to his lips. He tasted and made a wry face, but presently he began to sip and ultimately swallowed it all. The effect of the stimulant was wonderful, for in a few minutes he came to life completely, and was even able to sit up without support. For a long while he gazed at us gravely, taking us in and everything connected with us. For instance, Bickley's medicine case, which lay open, showing the little vulcanite tubes, a few instruments, and other outfit, engaged his particular attention, and I saw at once that he understood what it was. Thus, his arm still smarted where the needle had been driven in, and on the blanket lay the syringe. He looked at his arm, then looked at the syringe, and nodded. The paraffin hurricane lamps also seemed to interest and win his approval. We two men, as I thought, attracted him least of all. He just sunned us up and our garments, most especially the garments, with a few shrewd glances, and then seemed to turn his thoughts to Tommy, who had seated himself quite contentedly at his side, evidently accepting him as a new addition to our party. I confess that this behavior on Tommy's part reassured me not a little. I am a great believer in the instincts of animals, especially of dogs, and I felt certain that if this man had not been, in all essentials, human like ourselves, Tommy would not have tolerated him. In the same way, the sleeper's clear liking for Tommy, at whom he looked much oftener and with greater kindness than he did at us, suggested that there was goodness in him somewhere, since although a dog in its wonderful tolerance may love a bad person in whom it smells out hidden virtue, no really bad person ever loved a dog, or, I may add, a child or a flower. As a matter of fact, the old god, as we had christened him while he was in his coffin, during all our association with him cared infinitely more for Tommy than he did for any of us, a circumstance that ultimately was not without its influence upon our fortunes. But for this, there was a reason, as we learned afterwards. Also, he was not really so amiable as I had hoped. When we had looked at each other for a long while, the sleeper began to arrange his beard, of which the length seemed to surprise him, especially as Tommy was seated on one end of it. Finding this out, and apparently not wishing to disturb Tommy, he gave up the occupation, and after one or two attempts, for his tongue and lips still seemed to be stiff, addressed us in some sonorous and musical language, unlike any that we had ever heard. We shook our heads. Then by an afterthought I said, "Good day" to him, in the language of the Orophanans. He puzzled over the word as though it were more or less familiar to him, and when I repeated it, gave it back to me with a difference indeed, but in a way which convinced us that he quite understood what I meant. The conversation went no further at the moment, because just then some memory seemed to strike him. He was sitting with his back against the coffin of the glittering lady, whom, therefore, he had not seen. Now he began to turn around, and being too weak to do so, motioned me to help him. I obeyed, while Bickley, guessing his purpose, held up one of the hurricane lamps that he might see better. With a kind of fierce eagerness he surveyed her who lay within the coffin, and after he had done so uttered a sigh as of intense relief. Next he pointed to the metal cup out of which he had drunk. Bickley filled it again from the thermos flask, which I observed excited his keen interest, for, having touched the flask with his hand and found that it was cool, he appeared to marvel that the fluid coming from it should be hot and steaming. Presently he smiled as though he had got the clue to the mystery, and swallowed his second drink of coffee and spirit. This done, he motioned us to lift the lid of the lady's coffin, pointing out a certain catch in the bolts, which at first we could not master, for it will be remembered that on this coffin these were shot. In the end, by pursuing the same methods that we had used in the instance of his own, we raised the coffin lid, and once more were driven to retreat from the sepulchre for a while by the overpowering odor like to that of a whole greenhouse full of tuberoses that flowed out of it, inducing a kind of stupefaction from which even Tommy fled. When we returned, it was to find the man kneeling by the side of the coffin, for as yet he could not stand, with his glowing eyes fixed upon the face of her who slept therein, and waving his long arms above her. "Hypnotic business. Wonder if it will work," whispered Bickley. Then he lifted the syringe and looked inquiringly at the man, who shook his head and went on with his mesmeric passes. I crept round him, and took my stand by the sleeper's head, that I might watch her face, which was well worth watching, while Bickley, with his medicine at hand, remained near her feet. I think engaged in disinfecting the syringe in some spirit or acid. I believe he was about to make an attempt to use it when suddenly, as though beneath the influence of the hypnotic passes, a change appeared on the glittering lady's face. Hitherto, beautiful as it was, it had been a dead face, the one of a person who had been suddenly cut off while in full health and vigor a few hours, or at the most a day or so before. Now it began to live again. It was as though the spirit were returning from afar, and not without toil and tribulation. Expression after expression flitted across the features. Indeed, these seemed to change so much from moment to moment that they might have belonged to several different individuals, though each was beautiful. The fact of these remarkable changes, with the suggestion of multiform personalities which they conveyed, impressed both Bickley and myself very much indeed. Then the breast heaved tumultuously. It even appeared to struggle. Next, the eyes opened. They were full of wonder, even of fear. But oh, what marvelous eyes! I do not know how to describe them. I cannot even state their exact color, except that it was dark, something like the blue of sapphires in the deepest tint, and yet not black. Large, too, and soft as a deer's. They shut again, as though the light hurt them, then once more opened and wandered about, apparently without seeing. At length they found my face, for I was still bending over her, and resting there appeared to take it in by degrees. More, it seemed to touch and stir some human spring in the still sleeping heart. At least, the fear passed from her features, and was replaced by a faint smile, such as a patient sometimes gives to one known and well-loved as the effects of chloroform pass away. For a while, she looked at me with an earnest, searching gaze, then suddenly, for the first time moving her arms, lifted them and threw them around my neck. The old man stared, bending his imperial brows into a little frown, but did nothing. Bickley stared also through his glasses and sniffed as though in disapproval, while I remained quite still, fighting with a wild impulse to kiss her on the lips, as one would an awakening and beloved child. I doubt if I could have done so, however, for really I was immovable. My heart seemed to stop and all my muscles to be paralyzed. I do not know for how long this endured, but I do know how it ended. Presently, in the intense silence, I heard Baston's heavy voice, and looking round, saw his big head projecting into the sepulchre.
"Well, I never," he said. "You seem to have woke them up with a vengeance. If you begin like that with the lady, there will be complications before you have done, Arbuthnot."
Talk of being brought back to earth with a rush! I could have killed Baston, and Bickley, turning on him like a tiger, told him to be off, find wood, and light a large fire in front of the statue. I think he was about to argue when the ancient gave him a glance of his fierce eyes, which alarmed him, and he departed, bewildered, to return presently with the wood. But the sound of his voice had broken the spell. The lady let her arms fall with a start and shut her eyes again, seeming to faint. Bickley sprang forward with the sal volatile and applied it to her nostrils, the ancient not interfering, for he seemed to recognize that he had to deal with a man of skill, and one who meant well by them. In the end, we brought her round again, and, to omit details, Bickley gave her not coffee and brandy, but a mixture he compounded of hot water, preserved milk, and meat essence. The effect of it on her was wonderful, since a few minutes after swallowing it, she sat up in the coffin. Then we lifted her from that narrow bed in which she had slept for, how long, and perceived that beneath her also were crystal boxes of the radiant heat-giving substance. We set her on the floor of the sepulchre, wrapping her also in a blanket. Now it was that Tommy, after frisking round her as though in welcome of an old friend, calmly established himself beside her and laid his black head upon her knee. She noted it, and smiled for the first time, marvelously sweet and gentle smile. More, she placed her slender hand upon the dog and stroked him feebly. Bickley tried to make her drink more of the mixture, but she refused, motioning him to give it to Tommy. This, however, he would not do, because there was but one cup. Presently both of the sleepers began to shiver, which caused Bickley anxiety. Abusing Baston beneath his breath for being so long with the fire, he drew the blankets closer about them. Then an idea came to him, and he examined the glowing boxes in the coffin. They were loose, being merely set in prepared cavities in the crystal. Wrapping our handkerchiefs about his hand, he took them out and placed them around the wakened patients, a proceeding of which the ancient nodded approval. Just then, too, Baston returned with his first load of firewood, and soon we had a merry blaze going just outside the sepulchre. I saw that they observed the lighting of this fire by means of a match with much interest. Now they grew warm again, as indeed did we also, too warm. Then in my turn I had an idea. I knew that by now the sun would be beating hotly against the rock of the mount, and suggested to Bickley that, if possible, the best thing we could do would be to get them into its life-giving rays. He agreed, if we could make them understand, and they were able to walk. So I tried. First, I directed the ancient's attention to the mouth of the cave, which at this distance showed as a white circle of light. He looked at it, and then at me, with grave inquiry. I made motions to suggest that he should proceed there, repeating the word sun in the Orophanan tongue. He understood at once, though whether he read my mind rather than what I said, I am not sure. Apparently the glittering lady understood also, and seemed to be most anxious to go. Only, she looked rather pitifully at her feet and shook her head. This decided me. I do not know if I have mentioned anywhere that I am a tall man and very muscular. She was tall also, but as I judged, not so very heavy after her long fast. At any rate, I felt quite certain that I could carry her for that distance. Stooping down, I lifted her up, signing to her to put her arms around my neck, which she did. Then, calling to Bickley and Baston to bring along the ancient between them, with some difficulty I struggled out of the sepulchre and started down the cave. She was more heavy than I thought, and yet I could have wished the journey longer. To begin with, she seemed quite trustful and happy in my arms, where she lay with her head against my shoulder, smiling a little as a child might do, especially when I had to stop and throw her long hair around my neck like a muffler to prevent it trailing in the dust. A bundle of lavender or a truss of new-mown hay could not have been more sweet to carry. and there was something electric about the touch of her, which went through and through me. Very soon it was over, and we were out of the cave into the full glory of the tropical sun. At first, that her eyes might become accustomed to its light and her awakened body to its heat, I set her down where shadow fell from the overhanging rock, in a canvas deck chair that had been brought by Marama with the other things, throwing the rug about her to protect her from such wind as there was. She nestled gratefully into the soft seat and shut her eyes, for the motion had tired her. I noted, however, that she drew in the sweet air with long breaths. Then I turned to observe the arrival of the Ancient, who was being borne between Bickley and Baston in what children know as a dandy chair, which is formed by two people crossing their hands in a peculiar fashion. It says much for the tremendous dignity of his presence that even thus, with one arm round the neck of Bickley and the other round that of Baston, and his long white beard falling almost to the ground, he still looked most imposing. Unfortunately, however, just as they were emerging from the cave, Baston, always the most awkward of creatures, managed to leave hold with one hand so that his passenger nearly came to the ground. Never shall I forget the look that he gave him. Indeed, I think that from this moment he hated Baston. Bickley, he respected as a man of intelligence and learning, although in comparison with his own, the latter was infantile and crude. Me he tolerated and even liked, but Baston he detested. The only one of our party for whom he felt anything approaching real affection was the spaniel Tommy. We set him down, fortunately uninjured, on some rugs and also in the shadow. Then after a little while we moved both of them into the sun. It was quite curious to see them expand there. As Bickley said, what happened to them might well be compared to the development of a butterfly, which has just broken from the living grave of its chrysalis and crept into the full, hot radiance of the light. Its crinkled wings unfold, their brilliant tints develop. In an hour or two it is perfect, glorious, prepared for life and flight, a new creature. So it was with this pair. From moment to moment they gathered strength and vigor. Nearby to them, as it happened, stood a large basket of the luscious native fruits brought that morning by the Orophanans, and at these the lady looked with longing. With Bickley's permission, I offered them to her and to the Ancient, first peeling them with my fingers. They ate of them greedily a full meal, and would have gone on had not the stern Bickley, fearing untoward consequences, removed the basket. Again the results were wonderful, for half an hour afterwards they seemed to be quite strong. With my assistance, the glittering lady, as I still call her, for at that time I did not know her name, rose from the chair, and leaning on me, tottered a few steps forward. Then she stood looking at the sky and all the lovely panorama of nature beneath, and stretching out her arms as though in worship. Oh, how beautiful she seemed with the sunlight shining on her heavenly face! Now, for the first time, I heard her voice. It was soft and deep, yet in it was a curious bell-like tone that seemed to vibrate like the sound of chimes heard from far away. Never have I listened to such another voice. She pointed to the sun, whereof the light turned her radiant hair and garments to a kind of golden glory, and called it by some name that I could not understand. I shook my head, whereon she gave it a different name, taken, I suppose, from another language. Again I shook my head, and she tried a third time. To my delight, this word was practically the same that the Orophanans used for sun. Yes, I said, speaking very slowly, so it is called by the people of this land. She understood, for she answered in much the same language, what then do you call it? Sun in the English tongue, I replied. Sun, English, she repeated after me, then added, how are you named, wanderer? Humphrey, I answered. Humphrey, she said, as though she were learning the word. And those? Baston and Bickley, I replied. Over these patronymics she shook her head, as yet they were too much for her. How are you named, sleeper? I asked. Eva, she answered. A beautiful name for one who is beautiful, I declared with enthusiasm. Of course, always in the rich Orophanan dialect, which by now I could talk well enough. She repeated the words once or twice, then of a sudden caught their meaning, for she smiled and even colored, saying hastily with a wave of her hand towards the Ancient, who stood at a distance between Baston and Bickley, my father, Oro, great man, great king, great god. At this information I started, for it was startling to learn that here was the original Oro, who was still worshipped by the Orophanans, although of his actual existence they had known nothing for unaccounted time. Also, I was glad to learn that he was her father and not her old husband, for to me that would have been horrible, a desecration too deep for words. How long did you sleep, Eva? I asked, pointing toward the sepulchre in the cave. After a little thought she understood, and shook her head hopelessly. Then, by an afterthought, she said, stars tell Oro tonight. So Oro was an astronomer as well as a king and a god. I had guessed as much from those plates in the coffin, which seemed to have stars engraved on them. At this point our conversation came to an end, for the Ancient himself approached, leaning on the arm of Bickley, who was engaged in an animated argument with Baston. "For heaven's sake," said Bickley, "keep your theology to yourself at present. If you upset the old fellow and put him in a temper, he may die."
If a man tells me that he is a god, it is my duty to tell him that he is a liar, replied Baston obstinately.
Which you did, Baston, only fortunately he did not understand you, but for your own sake I advise you not to take liberties. He is not one, I think, with whom it is wise to trifle. I think he seems thirsty. Go and get some water, from the rain pool, not from the lake.
Baston departed, and presently returned with an aluminium jug full of pure water and a glass. Bickley poured some of it into a glass and handed it to Eva, who bent her head in thanks. Then she did a curious thing. Having first lifted the glass with both hands to the sky, and held it so for a few seconds, she turned, and with an obeisance poured a little of it on the ground before her father's feet. A libation, thought I to myself, and evidently Baston agreed with me, for I heard him mutter,
I believe she is making a heathen offering.
Doubtless we were right, for Oro accepted the homage by a little motion of the head. After this, at a sign from him, she drank the water. Then the glass was refilled and handed to Oro, who also held it toward the sky. He, however, made no libation but drank at once, two tumblers of it in rapid succession. By now, the direct sunlight was passing from the mouth of the cave, and though it was hot enough, both of them shivered a little. They spoke together in some language of which we could not understand a word, as though they were debating what their course of action should be. The dispute was long and earnest. Had we known what was passing, which I learned afterwards, it would have made us sufficiently anxious, for the point at issue was nothing less than whether we should or should not be forthwith destroyed, an end, it appears, that Oro was quite capable of bringing about if he so pleased. Eva, however, had very clear views of her own on the matter, and as I gather, even dared to threaten that she would protect us by the use of certain powers at her command, though what these were I do not know. While the event hung doubtful, Tommy, who was growing bored with these long proceedings, picked up a bough still covered with flowers, which, after their pretty fashion, the Orophanans had placed on the top of one of the baskets of food. This small bough he brought and laid at the feet of Oro, no doubt in the hope that he would throw it for him to fetch, a game in which the dog delighted. For some reason, Oro saw an omen in this simple canine performance, or he may have thought that the dog was making an offering to him, for he put his thin hand to his brow and thought a while, then motioned to Baston to pick up the bough and give it to him. Next, he spoke to his daughter as though assenting to something, for I saw her sigh in relief. No wonder, for he was conveying his decision to spare our lives and admit us to their fellowship. After this, again they talked, but in quite a different tone and manner. Then the glittering lady said to me, in her slow and archaic Orophanan,
We go to rest. You must not follow. We come back, perhaps tonight, perhaps next night. We are quite safe. You are quite safe under the beard of Oro. Spirit of Oro watch you. You understand?
I said I understood, whereon she answered,
Goodbye, O Humphrey.
Goodbye, O Eva, I replied, bowing. Thereupon they turned, and, refusing all assistance from us, vanished into the darkness of the cave, leaning upon each other and walking slowly.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/publius_reads. Thank you.
Super.